ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, a Category 3 cyclone batters remote communities in the Northern Territory, and it's feared there's worse to come as Megan makes its way inland. Also, the Liberal Party under fire from its own after a pre-selection battle sees an experienced woman lose her top spot on the Senate ticket to a man. And one life tragically lost, but two saved, as a hero plunges into the waters off a remote Victorian beach.
I kind of just jumped into action without really thinking about what I was doing. I feel like I did everything that I could have done to help them, so yeah.
To the Northern Territory first this evening, and the Australian Defence Force and government agencies have had to suspend plans to evacuate communities in the path of a Category 3 cyclone, which is heading towards the mining town of Borroloola. Cyclone Megan has already caused major damage to infrastructure on island communities off the Territory's coast, and some Indigenous residents of Borroloola are now asking if the government response has been too slow. Our reporter Jane Barden is in Darwin. Jane, what's the latest on Cyclone Megan's progress?
Well, we have the remote community of Borroloola really bracing for impact any time this evening. They've been given quite vague information that the cyclone is moving faster than expected, but may come just sometime this evening. So feeling very anxious there in that Indigenous community and mining town.
And what damage has Cyclone Megan caused already?
It's already caused significant damage on the remote island of Groote Island, 50 kilometres off the NT coast, damaging infrastructure and flooding in quite a lot of Arnhem Land communities as well. What started as a tropical low hovering around the top end last week became Category 3 Cyclone Megan, smashing into Indigenous communities and a major manganese mine on Groote Island off the NT coast at the weekend. Coralie Ferguson manages community businesses on the island and is on its emergency management committee.
I've had no alerts about any injuries, but quite a lot of trees down. The highway was cut. It was like a torrential river. Anuragu has had no power for 2 days now, and they had shortages of water as well. It's certainly a disaster.
The port for the island's mine has been damaged by a dock ship as it was pushed around by the cyclone. But Coralie Ferguson says police have been able to bring food into communities and rescued 9 people from the flooded airport.
And they did it on foot with ropes.
Wowie.
It was a torrent.
Some of the 800 Indigenous residents in the Gulf of Carpentaria town of Borroloola feel as the cyclone bears down on them, an NT government and Australian Defence Force plan to fly them out on military planes came too late. Borroloola resident Joni Wilson is among 300 people who went to the local council office early in the morning to request transport.
Yeah, we're worried now because we were up at 7 o'clock this morning. We didn't have any breakfast or anything like that. There's old people, young people, kids. We're all hungry. We've got no place to go but here. Yeah, we're scared here. There's still people out bush that haven't come in town yet.
Yeah, that must be a very worrying situation for you.
Yeah, we also have a pregnant woman here that has, they have 2 to 3 weeks to go, about 5 of them.
Borroloola Garawa elder Jack Green was among hundreds who were evacuated promptly by defence plane in 2019 when another cyclone Trevor approached the town. He thinks this time authorities moved too late.
Yeah, well, we are worried about it. That cyclone's going to hit. People are going to be stranded here, you know, because they should organise this thing a bit earlier. This time when they knew the cyclone was out there, you know, we'd all piled up under this tin shelter like a cattle.
The town's promised cyclone shelter hasn't been completed. Cyclone Police Incident Controller Sonia Keenan says plans to fly people from the small airstrip in Borroloola to the nearby MacArthur River Mine Airport to get onto large defence aircraft started as soon as Air Force planes could get to the NT on Monday morning. But the strong wind and rain has stopped the defence planes being able to land.
As such, the evacuation was called off this afternoon, and we have now moved to requesting that all the residents of Borroloola find a safe place to shelter. And we have strongly encouraged people to find houses that have been built to code, houses that are fairly new and built in the community that are at high ground and are also strongly built for the conditions.
NT Chief Minister Eva Lawler rejected any suggestion of late action by the governments.
No, definitely not. We've been watching it very, very closely, and it really has been only in the last few days where we've seen it turn southwesterly. We were thinking that it might have kept going straight through and gone through Queensland.
Federal Assistant Indigenous Affairs Minister Mulindiri McCarthy says her government responded to the NT's request for help promptly.
When that came through to Senator Murray Watt, who's the relevant minister that makes these decisions at a federal level, he approved the ADF being involved.
The MacArthur River Mines Community Superintendent Tracy Jones says the company still stands ready to provide food and support.
We're ready if they do come to the mine site, we're ready to help. We're hoping that everyone is able to ride this storm out safely.
The NT government is warning of flooding across the Gulf of Carpentaria and Barkly. It's hoping the cyclone will weaken as it moves west inland. But Borroloola residents, including Daphne Mawson, who've been through previous cyclones, are dreading what they may find when they return to their homes after this one has passed.
If my family were in a cyclone, that would have been clever. I was one of the lucky ones. My house was not damaged, but we did get water through the windows and stuff, so I had to throw out carpets and mats. It's not nice afterwards. It's just wet and soggy and smelly, like even the grass rots.
Borroloola resident Daphne Mawson talking to our reporter Jane Barden. The Liberal Party is again grappling with its troubles attracting and retaining female parliamentarians after one of its most senior members, health spokeswoman Anne Rustin, was relegated to second spot on the South Australian Senate ticket. She was pipped by a male senator with far less experience but far more factional support. Our National Affairs editor Melissa Clark is in Parliament House in Canberra. So, Mel, take us through the South Australian Liberal Party's process at the weekend that led to Anne Rustin being pipped by Alex Antic.
So this was the pre-selection for the positions on the Senate ticket. And basically, if you're on the top of the ticket, you're more likely to win a seat. Now, the most senior South Australian Liberal up for re-election at the next election is Anne Rustin. She's the former Social Services Minister. Currently, she's got the health portfolio, so a senior person on the front bench. But the result of this pre-selection at the weekend was that the South Australian Liberal Party members voted to put Alex Antic at the top of the ticket. He's a backbencher. This is his first term. And also he's a hardline conservative, while Rustin is a more moderate person in the South Australian Liberal Party. Quite simply, he had the numbers to get the number one spot.
How common are these battles for the top spot on a Senate ticket?
Look, it's actually quite common, and it's certainly not just the Liberal Party. There's another good example recently from South Australia in the Labor Party, where Don Farrell, who is a factional power broker in South Australia, he was pre-selected ahead of Penny Wong, who is one of the most senior women in the Labor Party. And in the end, it was only because he agreed to swap places that Penny Wong secured the top place. Look, when it comes to first position or second position, it's not necessarily that big a deal, because in this case, both Anne Rustin and Alex Antic are likely to be re-elected. They're pretty safe spots. But the symbolism is pretty important. And what this is telling us is that the Liberal Party is preferencing, in this case, Alex Antic as a conservative, relatively inexperienced individual ahead of a very senior and very experienced moderate female. This is something we're seeing in the Liberal Party. It's somewhat following a pattern of the Victorian Liberal Party a few years ago, where an influx of more conservative voting, often church-affiliated members, have been mobilised around conservative issues, and that's leading to pre-selections of candidates like Alex Antic. And look, it's not just in Senate positions. We're seeing this in the House of Representatives too. We've had the seat of Dunkley recently contested in a by-election, where we've had a male pre-selected for the Liberal Party against a push by many within the party to have a female pre-selected. Similar case has just gone on in the seat of Cook that has been made vacant by Scott Morrison's departure. And we're likely to see that battle play out again in the seat of McPherson, where Karen Andrews, again, another senior female on the front bench, she's indicated she'll retire at the next election. And it is looking like a male candidate will succeed in getting pre-selection for that seat, despite the push of many senior women to get a female pre-selected.
But the Liberal Party has the stated aim of reaching gender parity in its ranks by 2032. How is it going to do that with pre-selection outcomes like this?
That's a really good question. Look, it's going to be hard for the party to meet that target. Anne Rustin isn't commenting at the moment, but her colleague who sits on the front bench with her, Senator Jane Hume from Victoria, she's been among those pushing for greater representation of women in the party. And she's described this decision by the South Australian pre-selectors as a mistake, is the word she used, but noted she was pretty powerless to influence it because the way the Liberal Party works is that pre-selection comes down to the party members. It's not a matter for the parliamentary party. Alex Antic, for his part, says the gender card has been played. He's described it as a grievance narrative, saying the party just needs to focus on the best person for the job, regardless of gender or race or sexuality. So, look, while the party has this target of reaching gender parity by 2032, how to achieve that is very nebulous and not specified. And so far, it's looking like it's going to be a hard ask for the party to meet that target.
Our National Affairs editor, Melissa Clark, in Canberra. To the plans for the 2032 Brisbane Olympics now, and the Queensland government has flatly rejected a recommendation that it build a new $3 billion stadium for the event. The call for a new stadium on parkland in Brisbane came in a report the government commissioned. It's the latest development as the state works out how to build the venues needed to host the Games without blowing extraordinary sums of money in the process. The ABC's Lexi Hamilton-Smith is following this story. Lexi, first off, what did this report say about the need for a new stadium?
Well, hi Sam. It was run by former LNP Mayor Graham Quirk. Now, he said we desperately need a new stadium. A lot of the argy-bargy has been about our iconic Gabba. It's where the cricket has played. It's deteriorating and old. It doesn't have disabled access. It doesn't even have a female changing room area. So a lot of talk was that it has to go or be rebuilt, but the cost was blowing out. So Graham Quirk's looked at another option, as you said, looking at this parkland that's quite close to the city. He wanted a brand new stadium built, but the problem is the Gabba rebuild would have cost $2.6 billion, and his new concept is for an amazing stadium, a legacy stadium, but it would cost $3.4 billion. So where he was asked to look at the cost and come up with some better ways in this cost of living crisis, he's found one that's literally a billion dollars more expensive. And everyone today did not think that that was a good idea with some of those other issues that we're battling.
So the Premier, Stephen Miles, has immediately said no to the idea. Is the money the reason he's giving for that reaction?
Yeah, look, none of us were sure initially. They were being very quiet. They actually got the report on Friday, so they've had the weekend to look at it, and then suddenly they had launched their press conference to be at Suncorp Stadium. Then we realised that weeks ago, John Coates, who's on the IOC Committee for Australia, had leaked a story saying that he believed Suncorp Stadium, which is where we play the State of Origin and Rugby League, should be the best place for the opening and closing ceremonies. It already exists. Yeah, sure, it needs probably $500 million upgrade, a few more seats and better facilities, but it's already there. So he leaked that story, and then he also said that our athletics tracks that were used years ago for the Commonwealth Games, they're still being used, and he said once again, let's upgrade that. It's a lot less expensive than building new stadiums and tearing others down. So that is the outcome they came up with. They said, look, the report was great. We've recommended most of the recommendations, 27 of 30. But of course, the biggest one, which was the $3.4 billion legacy stadium, which would have lasted for another 40 years or so in Brisbane, it was a definite no. And it got back to that cost of living reason. Let's have a listen to Stephen Miles.
When Queenslanders are struggling with housing and other costs, I cannot justify to them spending $3.4 billion on a new stadium. I ordered this review because I had heard from Queenslanders that $2.7 billion at the Gabba was too much. So I know that for Queenslanders, $3.4 billion at Victoria Park will be too much.
The Queensland Premier, Stephen Miles. So, Lexi, what's the opposition saying about all this?
Look, the opposition has been banging on for months, and quite rightly, about the incredible blowout in costs, and saying because of our housing crisis, cost of living and all the other issues that we're facing, that we could never have afforded these expensive Olympic Games. So today they're saying we've gone back to the future, that the Labor government basically has stuffed up this whole process. They've botched it. They're saying 1,000 days ago, they called for an independent Olympic body to look at all the infrastructure. But of course, Anastasia Palaszczuk, our former premier, pulled everything into the premier's department, and that's where a lot of the problems seems to have arose. So the opposition is at this point saying we need another review. They're not happy even with this outcome. And I can tell you, Sam, over the weekend, you probably know we had two by-elections with massive swings of up to 20% against the Labor government here for general issues where people aren't happy, an election in October. So our biggest question today was, we've stuffed around 2 years of Olympic ability to start building. If the government fails and the opposition takes over in October, what happens then? We must surely be an embarrassment to the IOC. But I asked them that today and they laughed and said, of course we're not an embarrassment. We're on track and it's going to be fine. But gee, we've got a long way to go, I can tell you.
It sounds like plenty more twists and turns, Lexi. Thanks very much. Our reporter, Lexi Hamilton-Smith in Brisbane. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has secured another 6 years in power in an election international observers are calling a sham. The Russian government says he won nearly 90% of the vote. If Putin completes the term, he'll overtake 20th century Russian dictator Joseph Stalin as the country's longest serving leader. This report from John Daly.
Declaring victory and basking in the glory of what many see as a rubber-stamped election against no real competition, Vladimir Putin was triumphant.
People came to create the conditions for internal political consolidation to move forward. This unity will allow us to act effectively on the front line, in the economy, humanitarian development, achieving the goals of social development projects. We have huge development plans. People felt that and came to create the conditions for development and the strengthening of their fatherland, Russia.
President Putin won by a landslide, with exit polls showing he attracted 88% of the vote, the highest result in Russia's post-Soviet history. The win further cements his grip on power and follows the death of key opposition figure Alexei Navalny last month. The late dissident's wife, Yulia Navalnaya, urged people to show up at the polls at noon on the last day of voting. Queues formed outside polling stations with anti-Putin protesters heeding Yulia Navalnaya's call. At a polling station in Armenia, voters crossed the border from the neighbouring country of Georgia to take part.
Yes, I'm taking part in the midday against Putin action. I understood there would be many people, but I'm surprised at such an amount.
In Lebanon, voters seemed broadly supportive of the Kremlin.
You know the situation in Russia right now, which is why I believe we must support our president. I have supported him for a very long time, and today I once again made my choice.
We can see what the Americans are doing to us and the persecution that is taking place.
Dr. Ian Garner is an analyst of Russian culture and war propaganda, and he told News Radio the staged election comes at a definitive time in Putin's political career.
So showing that he's actually purportedly become more popular in the last couple of years is designed to show that Russians are embracing the new militarized direction for the country that he and his cabal of ruling elites have proposed.
The cards were certainly stacked in the Kremlin's favour, with no opposing candidates holding any real chance of victory. Alexei Muravyev is an associate professor of national security at Curtin University and an expert on Russian politics. He says even if a key figure like Alexei Navalny could run in a legitimate election, Putin would almost certainly have won anyway, thanks to his power base of working class voters.
As the old Russian saying goes, you don't change horses during the crossing. And the Russia right now is on the crossroads. So in any other way, we can question how many actual percentage Putin have won. But I cannot possibly imagine it would be lower than 70%. And even if we take 70% and as absolute conservative figure, it's still a landslide in victory for him compared to the way how the other candidates have performed.
Western governments and allies have condemned the election. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says it's nothing but a sham.
These days, the Russian dictator is simulating another election. Everyone in the world understands that this figure, as has often happened in history, has simply become addicted to power and is doing everything he can to rule forever.
Putin's consolidation of power comes as United Nations investigators say they've uncovered new evidence of widespread and systematic torture of Ukrainian prisoners of war by Russian jailers. Verinda Grover is a commissioner on the UN panel.
There are common recurring methods, brutal beating, relentless beating, administering of electric shocks, administering of cuts, sleep deprivation, deprivation of food, and even threats of rape.
After his victory, the Russian president gave a warning to the West that a direct conflict between Russia and US-led NATO forces would bring World War III one step closer. Something he says almost nobody wants to happen.
John Daly reporting. Well, if you have a question about anything in the world right now, you can find an answer online in a matter of seconds by tapping your query into a search engine. But now the National Consumer Watchdog is scrutinising those tools and in particular taking a look at Google's dominance of the market and what that means for Australian consumers. This report from Isabel Massali.
Perth woman Karen Dauncey teaches small businesses how to get more customers through a search engine. And you can probably guess which one we're talking about.
No one's ever asked me for, I think no one's ever asked me how to rank better on Bing.
She points out the dominance of Google is so big, people tend to use the phrase Google it instead of searching online. That means where certain results rank can make a big difference to consumers and businesses.
Google, in terms of the search landscape, have very little competition right now. Their market share is approximately 94%. I would probably say in any industry, it's not good for a business to have such a dominant market share because it doesn't give the user choice.
The Australian Competition and Consumer Commission is re-examining search engines in Australia and its potential impacts. Today, it's launched an appeal for consumers and businesses to share their thoughts on the competition in this space and how the quality is changing. Associate Professor Julia Powles examines technology regulation at the University of Western Australia.
So search is really the interface by which most people discover information now. When was the last time you went and consulted a library index, for example? It's a really key part of our information environment, of public discourse, of education and information retrieval. And we need to really watch how privatised that has become. It's essentially a private theme park at the front of how we discover information. And we really would benefit from getting under the hood of it, requiring certain expectations are met about competition and about choice and about transparency.
She says one of the issues being examined is the impact of artificial intelligence.
I did have a quick look through the 35 questions that the ACCC is asking consumers, And I was struck that right down in the 33rd question, we start to get to questions about search quality. And I think this is really the key issue with generative AI. What is the quality of the results that you get through search? There might be lots of problems with the popularity of results that come to the top of a Google search, but they are original content served back up to you through a search engine. Generative AI, of course, synthesizes many different results. It still has really significant issues of accuracy, of sourcing, of quality and of bias.
Recent changes made overseas is another reason the ACCC is taking another look at search engines. Catherine Kemp is an associate professor at the University of New South Wales.
We're seeing with the passage of the Digital Markets Act in Europe, new upfront rules about how certain digital platforms, including Google, have to conduct themselves in their markets. And for Google, this includes choice screens, giving consumers that upfront choice about who they're going to use as their search on their mobile or their desktop, as well as rules about self-preferencing.
Choice screens allow users to pick which browser they want to use. It's one approach that could reduce reliance on Google. And Dr. Kemp says greater competition is needed so Australians aren't limited to the information served to us by one company.
That report from Isabel Massali. A Victorian woman is being praised for her heroic bid to save three men who were drowning in the waters of an unpatrolled beach in the state's southwest yesterday. Brianna Hurst pulled the three swimmers from the surf near Apollo Bay. Sadly, one swimmer died at the scene. The other two were rushed to hospital. Safety experts say the rescue shows the importance of swimming lessons. This report from Oliver Gordon.
Brianna Hurst was enjoying a Sunday on the beach when a man came running from the water calling for help.
As soon as I realised what situation was, I jumped in.
There were three swimmers in the water, unconscious. The 33-year-old, who describes herself as a confident swimmer, wasted no time and says it was instinct that led her to help.
I kind of just jumped into action without really thinking about what I was doing.
Ms. Hurst swam about 20 metres to the first swimmer and dragged him back to the shore before heading back into the ocean a second and third time to retrieve the two other men. Other onlookers had gathered to help, performing CPR.
A lot of other people came and everyone was kind of helping out. A couple of doctors came as well, so they kind of led it from there once they arrived.
One of the men, aged 26, died at the scene. The other two, aged 23 and 24, were taken to hospital, where they remain. Victoria Police Senior Sergeant Stephen Bull has praised Brianna's efforts while highlighting the dangers of conducting a rescue on an unpatrolled beach.
She's put herself in danger to rescue three people that she didn't know at great risk to herself, so there's no other word that I can use other than heroic.
The ABC understands the group of men who are from Melbourne's western suburbs are part of the Indian-Australian community. The rescue comes just weeks after Victoria's worst beach drowning event in nearly 20 years at Phillip Island, which saw three members of Melbourne's Indian-Australian community die and another family member travelling from the country. Will Coon is the National Manager of Drowning Prevention Strategy at the Royal Lifesaving Society Australia.
We know from previous research that only about 40% of primary school age kids can meet the benchmark as they leave primary school of swimming continuously for 50 meters and being able to float or tread water for 2 minutes. And that number decreases as you get up into adolescence.
Throughout the COVID pandemic, many children missed out on months or years of swimming lessons, placing added pressure on schools and parents to improve their skills. Will Coon hopes lessons can be prioritised in school budgets in the same way they were in the 1980s and 1990s.
People were learning swimming in schools, across the country during those years. Those programs are less popular now. Those programs are impacted by budgets and impacted by other competing priorities. We've got pool infrastructure across the country that is crumbling. You know, pools that were built after the Melbourne Olympics or for the Melbourne Olympics are reaching the end of their lifespan in the next decade. And so you've got communities around the country who are facing, the potential to be without a community pool. And so not only is it about a growing population, not only is it about economic pressures, But this is about pool infrastructure. It's about a swimming teacher workforce. It's about a lifeguard workforce.
With the country's drowning fatality rate remaining stubbornly high, he's calling on all levels of government to do more to keep the country's swimming skills afloat.
We would strongly, you know, encourage all branches of government, federal, state, territory, and local governments to be prioritizing, you know, water safety education and promoting, you know, programs that teach young people core swimming and water safety skills.
Will Coon from the Royal Lifesaving Society Australia. That report from Oliver Gordon. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You'll find all our interviews and reports on the PM webpage, and you can listen to the program live or later on the ABC Listen app. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. The government's looking to shake up the aged care sector to make it much more user pays, particularly if you're a wealthy baby boomer. Today, investigative journalist Anne Connolly on what that means for the family inheritance. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.